coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
I don't know actually if trauma is at the root of all addictions. I think typically there is underlying trauma. I believe all of us have some sort of trauma. But, you know, to Gabor Mate's point, he says that addiction is the attempt to solve human pain, right? And so he says the question is not why the addiction, but why the pain. And from that perspective, you know, Iboga or Ibogaine is a root medicine, and we'll get to the root of that, bring it up. And then it's the person's choice if they're willing to look at it and use that in the months that follow to heal. But the important point is, I think Ibogaine gives you the choice back, because when you're in the throes of addiction, you lose the choice. So you have the ability to choose, do I want to go back to sleep, or do I want to now wake up and look at this pain and work with it and heal it actively on a daily basis? So that's why it's not a silver bullet, but it does give you the choice back.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a conversation series with leaders in the psychedelic community, specifically for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I am your host, Eamon Armstrong. Now, you may have noticed we've slowed the episodes a bit. We're doing about once a month for the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, but we will have many exciting guests coming your way, just at a slightly slower pace, which is somewhat the way the Bwiti people experience the world. Bwiti being the caretakers of the Iboga medicine of West Africa, which is what we'll be talking about on the show today. So the West African psychedelic Iboga and its extraction Ibogaine continue to show an impressive ability to heal addiction and trauma. And when done in a safe and ethical manner, there's very little risk of harm. Today, we are joined by Talia Eisenberg of Beyond, a Mexico-based Ibogaine treatment center. Our conversation begins with Talia's personal history and how addiction relates to trauma. We discuss Ibogaine integration to prevent relapse, and also how Beyond is designed to be a full-service wellness center for those healing from addiction and trauma. We conclude with Ibogaine's effectiveness in treating eating disorders and behavioral addictions, and Beyond's plan for rolling out future clinics. Talia is a serial entrepreneur focused on developing industry-leading consumer-facing products and services in the wellness and psychedelics industry. She is the founder of Beyond and also the Ibogaine Research Institute, a San Francisco-based nonprofit with the mission to raise funds and awareness required to provide people addicted to opiates the right to choose by legitimizing Ibogaine as the most promising solution for opioid addiction interruption. And now, here is Talia. Today, we're going to talk about addiction and particularly the value of Iboga / Ibogaine as a kind of master plant with working with addiction, with your work with Beyond, with your personal story. And we'll just get into all about how Iboga works, why it works, and what you're doing to help more people with it. So with that preamble, Talia, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It is an absolute pleasure.
And you know, it's interesting because you and I have started getting to know each other. We were connected through a mutual friend, and I've been checking out Beyond, and I've been super impressed by what's going on over there at Beyond. And so it's nice that we've got a little bit of a rapport. This is not our first time connecting. And so I already know a little bit about your story, which our audience will become acquainted with in just a moment. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have this opportunity to take our informal conversations and make them public and present for our audience today. So it's really a joy for me, and I'm excited that we're going to get to do it.
Thank you. Thank you for helping me to feel comfortable. And I'm excited to share, you know, my background and a little bit about what we're doing at Beyond.
Wonderful. So I often start conversations like these with my guests
connection to psychedelics, when they first tried psychedelics, what they meant, with how they use psychedelics. And when we're having a conversation about addiction, many folks who work in the psychedelic space are offering healing to the world that was the healing that they most needed at a pivotal point in their life. And so I'm curious for you, let's start with your relationship to addiction itself, because I know that you've had a personal journey with addiction. When was the first time in your life that you became aware that you may have an issue with compulsive behavior around a substance?
Yeah, so I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, which was already a little strange. You know, I come from an extremely liberal European Jewish family. My grandparents survived the Holocaust. My grandmother was in Auschwitz. And basically, they came to New York City after the war and were placed in Omaha, Nebraska, because they didn't want to be in New York. It was too traumatic. So I grew up in Omaha, and we traveled a lot in the summer to Europe and different parts of the world. And I always felt like an outsider in Omaha. And I went to a public high school, which was great, but I didn't have a lot in common with the other kids. So already I felt lonely and like an outsider. You know, I was popular on the outside, but very anxious and alone growing up. So I think the first time I tried a drug, I was 12 or 13, and it was Adderall. And I remember just feeling one with everything. And I remember I had a very fast car. And I remember being in the car and racing down the street and feeling very powerful, right? A false sense of power, but powerful. And I remember thinking, God, I'm going to do this every day. I finally feel like I'm home. So that was the first time. And, you know, it progressed from there. My father owned a bar. And in Omaha, there wasn't a lot of rules. I was friends with the teachers. I was friends with his friends. Basically, I was looking always for the next dopamine hit, whether it was behavioral or through substances. We had a place in New York City. We moved to Budapest when I was 15 for a year. I barely went to school there. On the weekends, I would go out to nightclubs. And then I dropped out of high school and moved to Istanbul and was surrounded by a very luxurious nightlife there, boats, and I was platinum blonde and pretty lost, trying to fit into a world that is not very deep. You know, I always had this philosophical rabbinical side and was looking for spiritual conversations, but liked to be numbed out at the same time. So I started using very hard drugs there, cocaine, things like that. And I became bulimic, you know, because that was the first real addiction. Before I needed drugs every day, was this filling up of food in my body and then releasing to feel a sense of freedom. And I'm sure I liked what it did for my neurotransmitters, the dopamine rush. And, you know, I also wanted to be very thin. And I was living in that there was like paparazzi and all sorts of reasons to be thin. So that's how it started. And then I moved back to New York City at 17, enrolled in college for about 6 months, quit college, started an art gallery in the Lower East Side where I showed young emerging artists and had parties every week. And you know, I surrounded myself with people that were high achieving, but also themselves were substance users and addicted. So it became normal in a way of life. And so that's basically what happened. That's how, you know, up until I was about 21, and that's when I started seeking help.
And so when you were in this space of addiction, we're talking about bulimia, also hard drugs, you're in this lost place, you started looking for help. Where's the first place that you looked for help? And what did looking for help look like for you at that age?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was lucky because my father had his own substance use issues. So he understood what it looked like. He didn't shame me. Every week, you know, we would meet in Soho where I lived in New York City. He lived nearby and we would talk about how I was doing with the bulimia, you know, the drug use. And he didn't shame me and I could have an open conversation with him about it. And he never told me to outright change. Of course, he wanted to help me because I was suffering. I was a shell of a human being. And then eventually he did, my mother and him did put me in a number of rehabs in 1 year. So it started with conversation and then, you know, these 30-day institutional runs where I would be locked up away from opiates. That was my drug of choice. And then I would come out. This went on for about a year. I would come out for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Physiologically, I would crave an opiate. There would be no stopping me. It's all I could think about. I would fly to Vietnam to get it, basically, or be in a bodega with my father and pretend like I was going to get milk and then have a dealer bring me the opiate in my hand secretly. And then I would, you know, I would need that, and I would go back into a rehab for another 30 days. So that's what help looked like. I also sought out therapists, did a lot of talk therapy where they explained to me why I was addicted. They drew diagrams explaining the physiological component, but I knew that I needed an experience and a physiological change.
You said you knew that you needed an experience. That's an interesting thing to have an awareness of at that time, because now when we're talking about psychedelic medicine, it really is experiential medicine in many cases. Psychedelics occasioning mystical experiences that lead to smoking cessation, for example, in the way that it's referred to in literature. You knew at the time that you needed both an experience and support in terms of physiological addiction, which that sounds a lot like Iboga. Is Iboga where you went to find those things?
Well, let's back up. I think the issue was that all of these people were talking to my intellect about how to end addiction. And I had known what love is from my grandmother, who had passed away maybe when I was 20, when I was going through the worst of addiction. She had taught me what love is. She had gone through the Holocaust. She had watched her brother die. Her father was taken from her. The worst tragedies to humankind. And yet she came out still very loving and empowered. And she taught me what that meant as a child and was there for me and showed up and was extremely present when I had a turbulent childhood. So I had known that experience, and I think that's what I was looking for, but didn't feel through these traditional rehabs or therapists, which were speaking to my intellect. I knew why I was addicted. I knew that it was physiological and that there was trauma underlying it all, but I couldn't get to the root of it. So basically what happened was my dear friend, who's now no longer with us, he actually died on his way to an Ibogaine clinic. His name's Matthew Mellon. He's fairly well known. He told me, you know, I used to go out with him in New York. I mean, as a friend, we would party a lot, and it was very decadent. And around that time when I was 21, 22, he told me about Ibogaine. He had successfully used it to interrupt his drug addiction, and he was already 3 years off of chemicals and remarried and doing very well. And he told me I should go try this. So, you know, I read about it online and made a few calls and was in Mexico within a week preparing for this treatment. Now, the medicine itself worked and it was miraculous. You know, within a few hours of taking Ibogaine, the cravings went away almost completely, which is, if you've ever seen an opiate addict withdrawing, it's why most people have a hard time getting off and get on Suboxone or methadone. And that's just another band-aid, you know? And so people stay on these substances for life and they're living in this sort of in-between state where they're never really breaking through and finding their true joy. So I found, you know, had, there's only a few clinics at that time in the world, and this particular clinic, you know, I think they meant well, they just lacked resources and organization and the financials to have proper preparation and integration. You know, I was told that there would be a doctor throughout the treatment. I was told that there would be labs and EKGs, and there wasn't. And there was also a bunch of very shady characters in the facility, to be honest, and I didn't feel safe. And to make a long story short, I ended up leaving the day after Ibogaine, leaving all my stuff there. The day after Ibogaine, you're pretty out of it. You can barely move. But I went out to the street where we were in this small town in Mexico and found a very nice family, paid them about $100, and they took me to the airport. And I got a flight back without telling the clinic where I was going, because I felt there was some weird sort of brainwashing going on, which after Ibogaine, you're very susceptible, more than any other psychedelic, I would say, to new ideas that are put into your head. So I left that and came back to the United States. And I was fortunate because I moved to Boulder. I found one of the first psychedelic therapists who worked for MAPS and started the MDMA trials. And she's an angel. She's in Boulder. And I started working with her weekly to make sense of what I saw on the Ibogaine while, you know, the Nor-Ibogaine was in my system for those 60 to 90 days and really got away from the New York environment, started doing yoga, started hiking, and really working on who I truly was, who I didn't know that at the time, and what I wanted to do with my life. So that was my experience. And since then, I've always had it in my heart to start something with the resources, with the therapists, with the trained medical doctors who our doctors have both more than 17 years of experience treating people with Ibogaine successfully without any fatalities, not one, probably 4,000 or more treatments together. And, you know, over the years, I've wanted to send people places. They come to me and say, we want to do Ibogaine, or I want to do Ibogaine, where should I go? And there's only a few places, and those places are safe, but they're more of a quick, we say, drive-by Ibogaine. There's not a lot of aftercare preparation. And we know when there's preparation and aftercare, success rates for whatever the end goal is for the individual are much greater. So with the psychedelic renaissance and with the opiate crisis right now, which is at an all-time high, you know, I think from 2020 to 2021, every week there was 45% more overdoses from the year before. And just this last year, there's been 100,000 overdoses in the U.S. just from opiates, which is more than ever. Essentially, it means 273 people are dying a day. That's a person every 5 minutes just from opiate overdoses. And that's because of fentanyl and a number of other reasons. But here we have a medicine that's been around probably since the beginning of time that works. It's not a silver bullet, but it interrupts addiction and makes it so you don't have to go through the agonizing withdrawals, you know, minimal withdrawals. And also you want to live, you find a reason for living. So during my experience, I saw the trajectory of life and death for humanity and how we always evolve. And I felt this internal struggle, this war between the light and the dark and how the light always wins out. And it felt like I was dying, you know, this pressure inside of me and my mind basically erased. And I thought I was going crazy and I could feel the Ibogaine working on my brain. And I thought I would never have a mind again. And really, that's what I needed looking back to lose my mind. You know, and I saw my grandmother and I saw the trauma and I could feel the trauma leaving my body that I was carrying on behalf of my family on that epigenetic level. And so, you know, that did it. And I haven't touched alcohol, opiates, or stimulants since. And that was 13 years ago. So it is a complete miracle, although it takes the work and the willingness, which is really step zero, to do the work. And something in me has spent the last 13 years seeking out healers, alternative medicines, going to energy medicine school and getting a master's in that myself, getting an MBA in sustainable systems. You know, how can we give back to the earth through business instead of extracting? Also shamanic, you know, I've been to Peru and drank ayahuasca with Shipibo as part of my regime, you know, every few years. So, you know, that desire to know God, which I had when I was doing opiates, you know, it was just a fake God. It was artificial. I still have that desire and I'm able to meet that force on a weekly basis alone now without substances.
Well, congratulations on that. That's inspiring. And I'm sure that people who have family members that they are concerned about, people who may be listening to this podcast who are trying to transition out of that addiction, compulsive behavior themselves are inspired to hear that. You mentioned that you were looking for both an experience and a physiological support and that Iboga/Ibogaine provided that for you. Can you tell us a bit about what is actually physiologically happening when someone takes ibogaine. Now, I understand that there is a mythic experience of sort of dreamlike visions, often a return to sort of childhood memories, really going to the root of traumas that may be what's creating these addictive patterns. But what's actually happening physiologically with ibogaine?
So physiologically, when you take ibogaine, there's still a lot unknown. And this is another piece we're working on, is the research piece and MRIs. But essentially, what is believed to happen is ibogaine is converted by the liver into something called noribogaine, which is a metabolite. And that remains in your system for up to 4 months. And it makes serotonin in your brain available. So it helps with depression and low, you know, moods and cravings and symptoms of withdrawals. And it targets brain regions affected by addiction, which help in the rewiring of the brain to basically revert to a pre-addictive state. There's a whole bunch of other things that happen, but there's multiple papers written on what exactly it does. And I'm not the expert. Our medical team knows more.
So in addition to the physiology, which is, of course, very complex, and the key factor being that it dramatically reduces withdrawal symptoms, there's the experience itself. And as you know, I had an experience of going to Gabon and sitting with the Bwiti doing iboga myself. And I recall speaking to Bwiti elders about addiction, which is a huge part of our conversation today, and many people who use ibogaine use it for addiction. And what I was told is that in the Bwiti perspective, in their metaphysical perspective, that addiction isn't really the thing that we think of it as, that addiction is really the compensation for deep pain, often childhood pain, developmental wounds, that sort of thing. But that there is a deep pain that's at the root of these compulsive patterns, and that iboga goes to the root of pain and reveals it and helps you work with it. My experience with iboga was that it took a very long time to integrate the revelation of that experience, because it, as you were speaking to in the beginning of the conversation, conceptually I understood like why I had the patterns that I had, but to actually feel and experience as an adult childhood trauma and deep pain is really an experience of kind of uprooting. Was that similar to the experience you had when you were reflecting on the intergenerational trauma that had been at the root of some of your addictive patterns?
Yeah, that's right. It is, because what happened is it showed me why, and the why, you know, is typically intellectual, but I could feel it from a different perspective and have compassion for the perpetrators. And that is an experience, right? It's much different than reading about it in a book or just deciding with your mind to look at it from a different perspective. It involves your heart and your body and an element of faith, you know, and trust. And compassion is a much higher vibration than just the intellect, I believe. You know, and to your point, I don't know actually if trauma is at the root of all addictions. I've heard the argument for, you know, we've seen people, some of our clients who become addicted to Vicodin just because their dentist gives it to them and they like it and they continue to do it. You know, it's more physiological. And so, and they don't have a lot of childhood trauma. So that's, I think, rare. I think typically there is underlying trauma. I believe all of us have some sort of trauma. But, you know, to Gabor Mate's point, he says that addiction is the attempt to solve human pain, right? And so he says the question is not why the addiction, but why the pain. And from that perspective, you know, iboga or ibogaine is a root medicine, and we'll get to the root of that, bring it up. And then it's the person's choice if they're willing to look at it and use that in the months that follow to heal. But the important point is, I think ibogaine gives you the choice back, because when you're in the throes of addiction, you lose the choice. So you have the ability to choose, do I want to go back to sleep? Or do I want to now wake up and look at this pain and work with it and heal it actively on a daily basis? So that's why it's not a silver bullet, but it does give you the choice back.
Well, yeah, and you're alluding to here the ever important issue of integration in terms of psychedelic therapy. I have heard, and my own experience bears this out, that Iboga / Ibogaine has the longest integration of any psychedelic. And that makes sense considering it is the longest experience because it can last a very long time. And when you were talking about your first experience with Iboga in Mexico, you were saying that there, the landscape of Iboga at that time, there wasn't really a lot around preparation and integration. So let's talk a little bit about integration. When you think about integration with psychedelics, is there more to the kind of obvious self-care routines that are necessary for the integration of Iboga? For example, if you are approaching this medicine from addiction, you're able to pass through with the withdrawal syndrome. You have the withdrawal symptoms. You have that choice that you're referring to. Is there a precise protocol of integration that is necessary to maintain the ability to be without that addiction?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in our program, we include at least 6 coaching sessions with specifically a trained Ibogaine coach who has had addiction, or if it's a trauma client, trauma-related issues, and used Ibogaine specifically. So that ability to connect with another guide who has been through it is huge, right? Because we know also the inverse of addiction is connection. You know, there was a study on rats. There's been multiple studies about how those that are experiencing addiction issues need community. So the coaching, the preparation, the clear intention on what you're looking to solve, and then the after for integration with this same coach all the way through is incredibly important. And we don't add that on as part of the package for extra cost, because we know that people may choose to not pay for it, thinking that Ibogaine is enough. So we eat that cost personally because we know how important it is. So there's that piece. Then there's the community piece. And, you know, that's why I think 12-step in some ways is so genius, and it's still around, right? It's been around since the 40s, I believe. And for all of its flaws and the disease model and other elements, it's pretty genius in that it gets people connecting without, you know, elements of their ego, who you are, what you do. It's the only place in the world where a janitor can sponsor, you know, a medical doctor. So that element we bring in, not necessarily 12-step, you know, we really try to customize our program. And if the individual likes 12-step, great, we'll direct them there. But there's other programs like Psychedelics in Recovery, and other programs like that, as well as we curate cohorts for weekly group sessions that they have via telemedicine. So they're connecting with others and sharing their daily challenges and their growths as well. So that's another element. And then a lot of the time, you know, people want to do more medicine afterwards. Sometimes they need another Ibogaine treatment every, you know, once a year. If they need that, we're there for them. But also other times, and our doctors recommend they wait at least 90 days, maybe they want to do ayahuasca or combo or something like that. And that will help further their clearing and knowing which direction they want to go in life, what they want to do with their career. So these are also important elements. And then, of course, we have a full-time psychologist on staff who's trained in Ibogaine and has been working specifically with Ibogaine for years. So she's there in the acute stages to help the person reintegrate.
Iboga is, in a sense, quite an exotic psychedelic for many folks. They haven't really heard much about it outside of perhaps Ibogaine for heroin addiction, for opiates. And the landscape of clinics has been a little bit unclear in terms of protocols, and perhaps in certain environments in terms of safety. So there have been a series of Ibogaine Iboga clinics in Mexico. There was Crossroads, which operated for a while, but the models for Ibogaine clinics haven't seemed to really solidified in terms of the landscape of psychedelic medicine. So let's talk a bit about Beyond. What makes Beyond special and different? And you mentioned there's a major safety component to Beyond. What makes Beyond different as a destination for Iboga and Ibogaine?
Sure. So many things. There is the safety aspect, of course. And what's happened with Beyond is our chief medical officer, Dr. Jeffrey Camlett, he was involved, 30 years ago in the original Ibogaine research in St. Kitts with Dr. Deborah Mash. And so he has a lot of experience as it relates to Ibogaine treatments. And then, he is one of the world's foremost safety experts. He's board certified in addiction medicine, and he has done a number of treatments over the years. And basically, he's the guy that other doctors call when there are particular cases, maybe high-risk cases with cardiovascular issues. So there's him. And then our other doctor who runs our facilities full-time comes from Clear Sky, which I believe Clear Sky has been around almost 20 years, and he was working there for 17 years weekly with, up to, 9 clients a week or something for 17 years. So he's seen every type of situation, every type of diagnosis, whether it's mental health or addiction. And those two together are a real force. So we have a set of safety protocols. We screen people very heavily before they come and when they arrive. There's a series of labs and EKGs, and then there's a whole psych exam that happens with our team. And then, of course, we have top of the line, almost ICU equipped rooms in our facility. We have a treatment house, and then we also have a wellness house, which is unheard of in the industry, where we separate those. First they have their treatment in this room. They have a nurse by their side the whole time. She's trained in emergency medicine. The doctor's there, the team's there. And then when they are stabilized a couple days later, they're brought to the well house, which is nearby. And just keeping those groups separate is totally different from what I've seen among these facilities. And, the other truth is that it takes resources and money. And our CEO is an incredible entrepreneur and has experience raising money and scaling businesses and creating protocols so that the business is able to grow and that, we can hire a number of team members and medical or mental health that are extremely skilled, and we can build the telemedicine platform. And I think there just hasn't been enough interest in Ibogaine, and most people that start Ibogaine facilities, they took Ibogaine themselves. They aren't medically trained, first of all. That's why there's been a number of deaths. And they also don't have the entrepreneurial management experience of growing a business so that we can truly reach those 100,000 people or more that die a year. That's what's needed. There's not actual solutions, and there hasn't been the team that's come in yet with the safety protocols, with the marketing skills, with the ability to scale. And then, of course, with this preparation and integration, long-term care to really create a difference with Ibogaine. And that's what we are poised to do.
So my experience was with Iboga. Ibogaine is the alkaloid extraction. And my experience was with the Bwiti people in Gabon, so in a traditional indigenous shamanic context. How does a clinical approach differ from a more kind of indigenous shamanic approach? And are there elements of the indigenous approach, are there elements of Bwiti that are part of Beyond's offering?
That's a great question. I think that, of course, we don't want to culturally appropriate, and the Bwiti elements are extremely important, but we're walking a fine line because right now, Ibogaine needs to be medically safe, right? Especially with the population we're working with who have all kinds of pre-existing underlying physical and psychological issues. So we bring in elements of ritual, that's for sure. you know, whether it's various ceremonies, discussions around intentions, dance, we have dance elements, you know, a lot of adjunct therapies and energy work. But I think what we're going to do is over time, we will also bring in more of the ritual for those that want it while holding on to the medical safety piece. But it is a very interesting question because it is challenging to combine the two and create an authentic experience and both be safe. So right now what we do just from a sustainability perspective and as a way to give back, you know, we believe it's important to bake in these ethos. So we partnered with Blessings of the Forest, which is a nonprofit organization in Gabon that gives back to the Bwiti and Iboga farmers. And so we're working with them, and that's a very good way to keep the conversation going and partner for the long term. But we would absolutely love to pay reverence and do more to incorporate the Bwiti rituals.
At the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned that bulimia was your first addiction. I'm curious what the difference in efficacy with Iboga or Ibogaine treatments are between these kind of more procedural or behavioral addictions versus more chemical physiological addictions. Now, I know that Iboga is especially efficacious for opiates and that has something to do with opiate receptors in the brain. But if let's say that someone is suffering from acute anorexia, it's threatening their life, they've tried everything that they can. Have you seen success with Ibogaine, and is that part of Beyond's offering?
Yes and yes. So specifically with eating disorders, there is a risk, which our doctors may rule people out. There's cardiovascular risk, you know, if you're bulimic. So we need to make sure EKGs occur, which they do anyways. So there's that. But from a behavioral addiction perspective, I've seen it work just as well. You know, it almost doesn't matter what the behavioral addiction or the substance is, because it interrupts and brings consciousness to your mind, where when you're about to do that thing, you don't need it anymore. You aren't even about to do that thing. You're thinking about something else. So it does work extremely well with proper therapy. You know, and then of course you need to bring in habits that are life-giving instead of that harmful habit. Instead, you can switch it in for something else. But it's a great question. And we currently have a journalist who is going to come down and write about her behavioral addiction with picking her face. She does it for like hours a night and can't stop. It's almost on rote. She doesn't even realize she's doing it. So that will be very interesting. There certainly needs to be more research done. And we are partnering with a number, you know, a Yale researcher and others to better show how Ibogaine works with various populations, not just opiates, but, you know, for trauma, for PTSD, for behavioral addictions. And that's something we'll be doing as we continue to see clients, right, is using the data anonymously to show the world that this works, especially when it's done in a safe and ethical manner. There's very little risk of harm.
So it seems like there's kind of a buffet of psychedelics available at this time for healing, and some of them seem to be specifically helpful for certain things. For example, ketamine is a great intervention for suicidal ideation and depression, although it may not have the long-term success of something like ayahuasca. Do you and Beyond have a desire to work with additional medicines? Do you feel like Ibogaine is the strongest support in all instances of addiction? Or are there times where you would meet with a client, have a conversation, and maybe the full-on breaking open the head Iboga experience is actually not necessarily for the goals that they have, and you might suggest a different medicine? Is that part of the conversation?
Yes, that is part of the conversation. I think our main focus is on Ibogaine just because it is so incredible for that addiction interruption, plus the neuroplasticity and the amount of time it stays in your body. But we are in discussion to offer 5-MeO-DMT as a possibility, because we've seen what's happened with about 450 Navy SEALs who suffer terrible PTSD after multiple tours in Iraq, who come home and want to kill themselves and their whole family, essentially. And how ibogaine paired with 5-MeO-DMT work extremely well together. It's like the ibogaine apparently, you know, gives you that life review and shows you what's going on. And then the 5-MeO clears out your body. And I believe it's all, you know, for TBI, actually traumatic brain injury that they face. So this is a Stanford study that's happening right now. And our chief medical officer is in charge of the screening for that study. So that looks very promising. And I think that could be part of our offering in the long run, you know, and offering other medicines too. I think it depends on the case by case basis. And I'm no expert at that, but I know our doctors and our medical team are talking about bringing other medicines for specific diagnoses. So yeah, I think that's an option. And many of these medicines work very well. There's one concern I do have is with ketamine, and when used in small doses, not under medical supervision, can be highly addictive if used, you know, through the nose because of the opioid receptors, and versus versus IV or intramuscular, where you get a much bigger dose. We've seen a number of people come to us with ketamine addiction problems. So we have to be careful there with offering something like that. And it has to be done with larger doses, with more time spread apart between administration.
I have a sort of side question on that. You said that it's more addictive in smaller doses through the nose because of opioid receptors. I hadn't heard this before, and I think that's very interesting because it's very socially popular to use ketamine. And I know that ketamine addiction is a major issue. And I didn't know that the encephalation approach was actually part of the addictive properties of it.
That's correct. That is what I've heard from the medical experts, that when used in small doses with much more frequency through your nose, it is more addictive because of what happens with the opioid receptors.
That is fascinating. Yeah. So one of the issues that faces the psychedelic renaissance is the issue of ethics in medicine. And one of the problems that comes up is an issue around venture-backed startups in healthcare, where there's a big push for exponential returns quickly. And when we're looking at psychedelic medicine and healing and safety, there can be pressure from investors to be able to move really fast. And I'm curious how Beyond is mitigating the issues around, you know, venture capital and financing in the context of psychedelic medicine. How do you maintain the slow growth and the checks and safety of the medicine and of the offering while taking financing that requires rapid returns and potentially, you know, an exit event?
Yes, that's a great question. So because we are in the telemedicine clinics business, traditional VCs don't expect the 20x return that they expect with biotech companies, many which are most likely going to go out of business, as we're seeing in the current market. Their valuations are too high and all sorts of things are happening there. So most of our investors know, first of all, they know what the mission is, which is to truly help end suffering, addiction, suffering that's at the core of addiction and PTSD. Knowing that, they don't expect crazy returns like, you know, like some of these biotech companies. So they understand that. But to be very frank, our margins are extremely good. We have the ability to treat a lot of people, to train other medical doctors. We have a very long list of doctors that want to learn how to work with ibogaine from our two main doctors. And we have the ability to grow faster. And we need capital to grow, right? And we're doing good work as long as we have protocols in place to maintain a standard of care that is the same across the board, that treats people with empathy like humans and helps ensure long-term recovery. So I don't think that is a problem. You know, and the investors that wanted crazy returns, they weren't for us. We've attracted people that want some returns on their investment, but they know that it's not going to be the next Pfizer-like medicine. So I hope that helps.
And in terms of the landscape and legality, most Ibogaine clinics have launched in Mexico. What's the regulatory landscape looking like in this moment and in the future in terms of where Beyond will be able to set up clinics? I know you're starting in Mexico, but what's the plan moving forward in terms of the rollout of future clinics? And what are some locations that you're looking at in the current legal climate and perhaps in a shifting legal climate?
Yeah. So Ibogaine is unscheduled in Mexico, meaning the government doesn't really pay attention to it. It's seen as an herb, just as other herbs are unscheduled. So, you know, there's been Ibogaine clinics in Mexico for 20 years now. So basically, Mexico is a good place. It's close to the U.S. We would like to have facilities next year outside of Mexico City, facilities closer to Texas so that there can be easier access for those that need it. We're talking to a number of people right now. There's options to, you know, put clinics in Belize and in Portugal and basically anywhere where this medicine is legal or unscheduled. We think that regulatory and legality, it's going to shift over time. We're already seeing a lot of very good progress from Texas, local Texas politicians, both right-wing conservatives and liberals who would like to see Ibogaine medicalized there, sort of like cannabis in other states where it's not legal on a federal level, but it's, you know, medicalized on a state level. So I think as we begin to do this work, as the data proves how effective this work is and how safe it can be when done in proper hands, we're going to be able to open a number of clinics all over, as well as, you know, telemedicine can go anywhere. So people can come and then go back home and work with us virtually.
So you are about to launch an insights discussion series, and the first will be with Dr. Gabor Mate. Can you tell me a little bit about the goal of Beyond's Ibogaine Insights discussion series and what you're hoping to be able to share with the world over these next couple of months in having these bi-monthly conversations?
So the idea related to the Ibogaine Insights series came from a true need for medical health, you know, and mental health professionals outside of psychedelics to be educated on what Ibogaine is and to be educated by other researchers, medical doctors, therapists, PhDs who've been working with Ibogaine for a number of years. We get a lot of inquiries from traditional, you know, Western therapists and medical doctors who are looking now for alternative solutions because of the psychedelic renaissance. And they want to know how we work, what our protocols are like, what the science is like, and how they can prepare their clients or at least qualify a client to see if they're a good fit for this particular treatment. So I think we have about 500 people signed up. It's a biweekly series that ends in August, and we're tackling, you know, a number of issues, including having Gabor Mate on tomorrow. He'll be talking about Ibogaine and trauma, addiction, and, you know, nutrition, preparation, how it works in the brain. We have, you know, Rick Doblin's coming on to speak about why the psycho-spiritual experience is so important when it comes to Ibogaine, because there's a number of biotech companies that believe you can remove the journey, the trip, and just have it be the noribogaine in your liver without the awakening and the insight. So Rick is going to speak about how Ibogaine helped him with his, I believe, perfectionism, he told me, heal his perfectionism issue. So yeah, it's going to be pretty great. And we'll have recordings. And if you sign up online at www.beyond.us, /Ibogaine, insights, you can get access to the Zoom, you know, recordings that way. And we, there's no why in the beyond. It's just B-E-O-N-D because we don't ask why. Why is not a spiritual question, as one of my spiritual teachers once told me.
Oh, I love that. I did not know that that's why there was no why. I thought it was just clever branding, but I like that there's no why because there is no why.
Well, to be honest, the URL wasn't available, but it's also true about the why and the spiritual question.
Oh, well, I like that. I like that. That's a great line. Talia, we're coming to the close of our conversation today, and I always like to give my guests the opportunity to speak directly to members of the psychedelic community, those who are healers, those who aspire to be, people who are doing this work. If you could speak to the people who are facilitating these journeys, helping these people heal, what would you say to them?
I would say come down to Beyond and see what we're doing. We're going to host, you know, complimentary sessions, week-long sessions, probably every 3 months for therapists, coaches, doctors to come and see what we're doing and learn firsthand how this medicine works and what it's like when it's done in a safe and ethical way.
I love that. Well, Talia, you already let us know about website. We'll have everything in the show notes. Where else can people follow Beyond or your work who are listening and intrigued by our conversation today?
You can follow us on Instagram, beond.us. We have a similar Twitter page and we have a Facebook page.
Beautiful. Well, Talia, thank you so much for coming on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I'm really inspired by what you and Beyond are doing, and I'm excited to track your work as it grows and to have you back on the show when we can look at what's happening with some of this research and how attitudes are changing around ibogaine around the world. And hopefully we can bring those numbers of fentanyl adulteration deaths and other opiate-related deaths down through being able to help people who need it most. And I appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. You are beyond awesome.
I love that. Thank you, Talia.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.